That was when I think we neutralized the tattoo evidence. Throw in the fact that he got several other tattoos, including one that read CBSWBS, meaning can't be stopped, won't be stopped, and IWBTG, standing for I will be the greatest. He also got song lyrics on his chest, and Shayana got the corresponding lyrics tattooed on herself. We also pointed out that Aaron went into the store looking for what is called a gun tree, that showed a tree with different guns hanging from it. Due to the lack of space on his body, Aaron ended up choosing the other tattoos. It turns out gun tattoos are very popular in the United States. They are symbols of strength and the refusal to be a victim. Their meanings are so subjective, they should never have seen the light of day in a courtroom. I think Judge Locke really dropped the ball on that one. Finally, the long-anticipated date arrived when the Commonwealth called Alexander Bradley to the stand. Like Aaron, he was taller than I expected. He stood about 6'2", around 230 pounds, in a muscular frame, much slimmer than he looked in the videos taken on the night of the Boston murders. He showed up wearing khakis and a black Burberry dress shirt that cost more than half of what our jurors made in a week. These were obviously clothes delivered to the jail by one of his baby mamas, Brooke Wilcox. That was a big mistake on Hagen's part. They did put reading glasses on him, which I thought was a nice touch. Bradley's direct went extremely well for the prosecution. Bradley is an intelligent drug dealer. He is well-spoken when he wants to be, and he really came across as believable when not pressured in any way. Before the trial began, I studied his testimony in the Odin Lloyd trial, and thought he was an excellent witness for the prosecution. He held up strongly during cross-examination. Of course, his testimony in that trial was not as significant as it would be in this one. But I could see his habits and gestures and knew what to look for as he testified. When on the stand, his language was formal. For example, he always referred to males as gentlemen. He would refer to the gentleman wearing a red tie as he identified someone. If he couldn't remember something, he would say, "I can't quite recall that." I also saw that if he was confronted with prior inconsistent statements, he would not fight to explain. He would say something along the lines of, "If that's what it says I said, then yes, that is correct." He clearly made an effort to clean up his act. I don't believe he was coached to do these things by a prosecutor. I think he was clever enough to know how he came across and never wanted to look ghetto on the stand. After going through Bradley's story of what happened in Boston, Hagen took him through the events in West Palm Beach, then began the tedious task of reading and going through each and every text message between him and Aaron after he got shot in West Palm Beach. That day, I wore a black suit and white shirt with a black tie. I guess it was my best Men in Black impersonation. I usually dressed with more color, and Mark Lee noticed. As soon as I walked in, he commented, "Jose, you look like you're dressed for a funeral." I responded, "Yes, I'm here for the Bradley funeral. We plan on burying him today." Unfortunately, the opportunity would not come that day, as Hagen lasted all day with Bradley, and we could tell at around 2 in the afternoon that the prosecution was going to use the old trick of marinating a jury. Basically, it's when prosecutors draw their case out so they can end court on a high note for the day. That is exactly what they did with Bradley. Hagen was not going to let me anywhere near him until the following day, so the jury could go home and think all night about Bradley's testimony. Unfortunately for them, they called Bradley more than halfway through their case. While he wasn't their last witness, he certainly appeared late in the second half of their case. I guess their thinking was that the jury would be hearing about Bradley day in and day out, and once he took the stand, he would bring together all the pieces for them. The problem with that approach is that we had been so strong in rebutting everything the prosecution was presenting that the jury had started getting used to hearing interesting theories from the Commonwealth, only to watch them get slammed by the defense on cross-examination. We had the feeling, watching their facial expressions, that the jury were literally waiting for the defense to get up so they could finally hear what was really going on with the evidence and hear the rest of the story, as famous radio personality Paul Harvey would say. I really do believe that if the prosecution had put Bradley on first, the defense would have had a much tougher job. But they chose another route. When they finally let me at him, I had seen enough of this prim and proper Bradley. So the first words out of my mouth were, "Who are you really?" "I'm sorry, Mr. Baez," he responded in his gentleman's voice. "Well, are you, as you describe," reading from his text messages, "the OG nigga wit weaponry that will make you cry fo yo mommy?" I said that in the best street voice I could muster. "Or are you, Like the gentleman seated next to the gentleman with the red tie, I said in a mocking, nerdy voice. This changed him instantly. He did not expect me to start mocking him from the beginning. I think he expected me to attack his statements and his actions and talk about his past. But I knew this was a man not used to being made fun of. He was dying to jump out of his seat and kick my ass right there. I then went into his aliases, including Sherrod the Shooter, which he denied going by. That didn't surprise me, but then he denied being called Rock, which I didn't expect because his jail calls were riddled with people calling him Rock because he liked to rock people to sleep, meaning kill them. When I confronted him with the jail calls, he claimed that his family called him Rocky, insinuating it was a term of endearment, like Joey is for Joseph. This was too good to be true. He now gave me the ultimate tool for mockery. Every time I wanted to piss him off, I would call him Rocky, as if it was the funniest thing I had ever heard. He took the bait and started saying my name as if it was the silliest word he had ever heard. For example, he might respond to my questions with something like, "That's correct, Mr. Baez," mocking my name as best he could. I had gotten him out of his comfort zone, but I knew I couldn't overdo it because he was smart enough to pick up on what I was doing. Plus, I also knew that during breaks the prosecution would make him aware that I was trying to provoke him. So I saved my Rockies for when it mattered. Because of his intelligence, I knew his cross-examination was not going to be a series of knockouts. Instead, his was going to have to be a death by a thousand cuts, so I tried my best to go through the facts in a methodical manner. I did want to set up the whole cross-examination by putting the deal that he cut with prosecutors front and center. We read through his proffer letter line by line, and I put the agreement on the projector multiple times. I focused on the 50 different places it said he had to give complete and truthful information. Then I went through all the different ways his statements were not complete or truthful. After each statement he gave that was either not complete or truthful, I asked whether the Commonwealth had revoked his deal, like the agreement said it would. I was a broken record until it became abundantly clear that he had way too many statements that were not complete or truthful, and the prosecution didn't care, and were still sticking with him despite his lies. Two villains, Bradley and the prosecution, or the twins of deception, as Johnny Cochran used to say. I then went through the text messages, pointing out that 90% of them were from him to Aaron. Aaron would chime in only on occasion to deny shooting him. Basically, all of Bradley's texts were simply self-serving statements. Bradley also referenced having contacted a lawyer early on, showing these texts were in anticipation of litigation was important. This would help the jury understand the mindset of both men as these texts were being exchanged, because Aaron was being advised by his agent Brian Murphy not to respond. The second day was more of the same. This time, I went through Bradley's text messages pointing out some of the slang Aaron had translated for us, messages the prosecutor skimmed through as if they had no meaning. They were texts about Bradley having wolves on deck, meaning Bradley had guys who were his shooters ready to kill Aaron. We also pulled out the text messages in which Bradley discussed his weaponry, an array of assault weapons. Not only did we discuss them, but I also went online and printed out pictures of them and had them admitted into evidence, then placed them on the overhead projector so the jury could see the tools of the drug trade. "Mr. Bradley, this gun that you reference in your text to Aaron is what kind of gun?" I asked. "Mac-10," he answered dryly. "And after you made your deal of a lifetime, when did the police or prosecutors go to your house and confiscate this Mac-10? I continued. "They didn't. I still have it," he answered to a stunned courtroom. "And what kind of gun is this?" I asked, moving on to his next weapon of choice. "An AK-47, he responded. "When did the police or prosecutors come and confiscate this gun?" I asked. "They never did," he answered. Then I went over the bulletproof vest he had, as if he was working part-time as a police officer somewhere. The picture was clear. Here was the prosecution's star witness and all his weaponry coming to a neighborhood near you in the not-too-distant future. Bradley was a convicted felon, and possessing these assault weapons was a serious crime. Not to mention he was sitting there after emptying a gun into a crowded nightclub. But prosecutors, intent on winning at all costs, were going to allow him to keep these weapons and put him on the streets again. His second day on the stand was the day the fireworks began. I wanted to leave the jury with a lasting impression of Bradley, and I didn't want it to be a pretty one. After cutting his deal with prosecutors, the police asked Bradley to help track down the text messages in which he claimed Aaron made incriminating statements. While there were no such things, Bradley did turn over one of his two phones, and when he did, the police had him and his attorney sign a release form. In the form, it stated that he was waiving all rights of confidentiality as they related to this cell phone. I could see the puzzled look on the prosecutor's faces as I began reviewing this form and showed it to the jury. Now it was time to bring down the hammer on Rocky, once and for all. I directed him to a text message Michelle had discovered among the deleted files on the phone, a message he sent to his lawyer, Robert Pickering, when he filed his lawsuit against Aaron after the shooting in West Palm Beach. Bradley thought the text had long been deleted. He was about to get a huge surprise. I read out the text as loudly as I could. "Now you sure once I withdraw this lawsuit, I won't be held on perjury after I tell the court the truth about me not recalling anything about who shot me?" The courtroom fell into complete silence. I could see Hagen's face turn red like a tomato. He was pissed at somebody, and it wasn't me. I then went through and explained that not only was this a confidential message, which at the time he wrote it Bradley believed was protected by attorney-client privilege, but he also believed the text message would never see the light of day, much less the inside of a courtroom. At that moment, I too decided to play the marinating a jury game and suggested to Judge Locke that this was a good time to break for lunch. At some point later on in the trial, Hagen and I had a moment of privacy. I said to him, "You acted like you didn't know about that text?" "No, I didn't," he answered. "I told Teresa to check and double-check all of those text messages to make sure there was nothing in there that hurt us, and she assured me that we were good." The person he was referring to was the third chair prosecutor, Teresa Anderson. She was their law person. Usually a member of the team focuses on all the legal research and memorandums of law. They don't usually question any of the witnesses or take a big role in the trial, but their importance to the team can never be overstated. I don't mention her much because she was not as outgoing as Hagen and Lee. I think she said 10 words to me during the 2 months we tried this case, and I'm pretty sure 9 of them were "good morning." She was of average build with red hair, pale skin, and glasses that seemed to eat up her face and any signs of a smile. But she was a head shaker. Whenever she heard something in the courtroom she didn't agree with, she would shake her head like a bobblehead. She wasn't as bad as Jeff Ashton, the laughing guy in the Casey Anthony trial, but definitely cut from the same cloth. Hagen then said to me, "Yeah, what's the old saying? You want something done right, you have to do it yourself." "Nah, man, don't be so hard on her," I said. I was lying. He should have. That was a colossal blunder. "It just proves my Michelle is better than yours," I quipped. "Apparently so," he said as he walked away. As I mentioned earlier, nothing gets past Michelle. During lunch, the courtroom was buzzing. We actually thought there was a possibility they would arrest Bradley for perjury. Maybe there was even an outside chance they would drop the charges against Aaron. After all, here was Bradley admitting to his lawyer in a confidential conversation that he in fact did not know who shot him in West Palm Beach, a fact he had just spent the last 2 days testifying about unequivocally and under oath. Instead, to my disappointment, the prosecutors doubled down. They wanted to try and exclude the text, claiming it was protected by attorney-client privilege. But Locke wasn't buying it. The waiver form was clear. Bradley had waived all privileges when he signed it and turned the phone over. It was a good day. I know it was as close as I will ever come to a Perry Mason moment in a courtroom. We savored it for the night, not knowing the prosecutors would declare World War III in court the next day. Chapter 20. Desperate Measures. After Bradley's "The Truth" text surfaced, the next trick up the prosecution's sleeve was Aaron's sexuality. They knew they would suffer a backlash if it came out that they were outing a man just to try and make some sense in their case. Massachusetts is a very liberal state. It was the first state to legalize gay marriage. How far did they think their information about Aaron's latent homosexuality would take them? But this bit of juicy information couldn't be left unused. They decided, after what appeared to be much contemplation, to leverage it by trying to get Shayana on their side. They believed that if they told Shayana about this other woman and the fact that Aaron was either gay or bisexual, somehow Shayana would turn on him and reveal something they didn't know, or at least sway her testimony in their direction. Meanwhile, police had also gone to visit another individual they believed had a relationship with Aaron. I am intentionally being vague here. All I will say is that the person I am referring to had connections to Aaron and was credible, and I confirmed the facts with both Aaron and the individual myself. This was someone known to both Aaron and Shayana, and he had in fact confirmed to the police that he had a romantic relationship with Aaron. They knew Shayana would feel betrayed, and considering the fact that she was the only person standing by Aaron, adding pressure to their relationship might shake things up enough for something useful to come loose and help their cause in some way, shape, or form. I got word that day from Shayana's lawyer that the prosecution wanted her to come to court so they could talk to her. They had something very important to tell her, something that she had to know, perhaps something life-changing. I immediately confronted Hagen on the issue and asked him if he intended to tell Shay about the gay issue. He told me, "Yes, I think she has the right to know, and I don't want her hearing about it for the first time when we put her on the stand." "Why and how would this ever come up on the stand, and how is it relevant to this case?" I asked in disgust. "I can't tell you that," he said, as if hiding a secret. I had to act, and act fast. The first thing I did was to tell Aaron. He was beside himself. I had never seen him like that before. He was so afraid of hurting Shay that he begged me to help him in some way. I told him, "Look, we just have to deal with this. I know it seems like the most important thing in the world right now, but, Aaron, it isn't. This trial is. We don't know what the future holds for you two, but we do know that your future depends on the outcome of this trial. So let's stay focused." Aaron began to cry. "But Jose, she'll be devastated," he wept. "I never meant to hurt her. I know I keep disappointing her, but she is my soul. She is all I have and all I ever will have." His tears kept flowing. "No, Aaron, Aviel is," I explained. He then said, "They both are, and I can't have that taken away from me." As he said this, I cursed Hagen. "I will talk to her. I will break it down, and I know she will be big enough to get through this," I said. "How do you know?" he said, looking hopeful. "Because look at all this other shit you put her through. If she stood by you through that, she is not going to abandon you now, especially knowing you two have a child to raise together. Everything else pales in comparison to this." For some reason, that gave Aaron solace. As the day went on, I didn't have any witnesses to cross-examine. Sully and Linda had most of the witnesses. I don't know what was being said in court that day, as I was in a complete daze. I had never been in a position like this before. This is the shit they don't cover in law school. In all the years I had practiced, I never thought I would have to have a conversation like this. I immediately called Shay and told her I needed to speak to her in private before she came to court that day. She already knew the prosecutors wanted to speak with her, so she wasn't surprised that I wanted to talk to her first to give her the heads up on what they were going to tell her. She was going to be late for court, so I told her to text me when she got in so I could pull her aside. When Shay's text came in, I told her to go to the 6th floor and wait for me near the elevators. Our courtroom was on the 9th floor, and I didn't want anyone seeing us talking or interrupting us. I literally walked out of the courtroom while a witness was testifying. As I slipped out, I don't think too many people noticed, although a reporter did tweet about me leaving at such an odd time. The 6th floor was practically deserted. It was as good a place as any to have the conversation. I paced back and forth as I waited for her to arrive. When she finally stepped out of the elevator, my heart warmed. Here was this beautiful, sophisticated woman who had so much love and compassion for Aaron. I couldn't hold back my nervousness. As we sat down on a wooden bench, no different than any wooden bench in courthouses across America, I had to tell her the most salacious secret in the highest profile case in America at the time. I explained to her about the woman the police had interviewed and what she told them. Then I told her about the man the police had used to confirm everything. While the news about the woman did not shake her, I could see the betrayal in her face when I mentioned the man. She knew him and had spent time with him and Aaron. She felt like a fool. "I want to be abundantly clear about something. I am not mentioning names for a reason. It is not my place to out anyone. What a person does in their personal life is their business, and I would never have even written about Aaron's relationship had Shayana not addressed the matter publicly herself. I don't feel it is anyone's place to do this except Shayana. Even with Aaron, their relationship was hers just as much as it was his. Only now, with her permission, can I share what we talked about that day." After Aaron passed, she did a sit-down interview with Dr. Phil, in which he asked her point-blank, "It was reported that he was gay. You were his fiancé. Was he secretly gay?" Shayana didn't hesitate with her response. "The Aaron that I knew? No," she said. "I had no indication or any feeling he was such. He was very much a man to me." I was a bit shocked by her answer, as I expected her to talk about our conversation on the sixth floor of the courthouse. She later explained to me that if he had asked me the question the right way, I would have answered it. But the way he asked me, I felt I had to answer it with what I felt in my heart at that moment to me was true, which was, yes, he was very much a man to me. In her second sit-down interview for a documentary series with the Oxygen Channel, she was finally asked about our conversation that day, and this is a direct quote of what she said. Question. Can you talk me through the moment of Jose talking you through bringing up Aaron's sexuality? Shay. Aaron's sexuality from what I've known? Question. Just talk me through Jose coming out to talk to you. Shay. Okay. Jose speaking to me about Aaron's sexuality was an intimate moment between Jose and I. We met on a bench and he kind of broke it down slowly. It was emotional. I cried because I was confused. Still kind of am. But I wouldn't fault Aaron for what he may or may not have wanted. I think I was more upset because I don't think I've chosen the path. I feel like it's been chosen for me, in a sense. It's maybe selfish, but I try to be very understanding. It may not be something that I want, but it's something that he may have been. Question. And you decided after Jose told you this that you're sticking with your guy? Shay. After Jose had broken everything down to me, there was some unsure parts because no one had answers. Everyone was speculating. I was speculating, and I think Jose was trying to protect me. But he let me know that I could go home and he would understand. Being the person that I am, I would not want him to go through anything by himself. I wouldn't want anyone that I care about going through anything by themselves. I was the only thing that he had at the second trial, even at the first trial, but more importantly at the second one. There's no way that he sees me and that I don't come back in. Hurt or not, and I was hurt, I had to fight through it. I had to fight through it, and I can't even say that we discussed it thoroughly because we never had time to. But I was willing to. I was willing to accept whatever was coming to me. I want to say that he understood that, but at the same time, I think he was just too scared, and I don't think that he knew how to confront me. Question. It says a lot about you that you went back into court. Shay. Oh, it took a lot. It took me a few minutes. But yes, I couldn't leave him by himself. Question. Can you talk about a reporter spilling out Aaron's sexuality to the public? Shay. Aaron's sexuality? I actually don't necessarily know about a specific reporter who leaked it. I was not familiar with that at all. Question. Did you know that someone had leaked the story and it had gone public? Shay. I did know that, you know, a reporter had leaked the story about Aaron's sexuality, yes. Question. How did you feel about that? Shay. It's frustrating that it wasn't in the way that we wanted if we wanted to release that information. I feel like people form opinions immediately instead of hearing Aaron's side because, you know, that's the only person that can necessarily say how he was feeling. It's something, of course, that we were all trying to get through and figure out what exactly was going on. Question. Did you feel like it was nobody's business in the first place? Shay. I think that Aaron's sexuality is absolutely no one's business. I think we're in a world now that things should be accepted regardless of how people want to live. I think there's things that should remain private. Shayana went home, but after much pain and soul-searching, she was back in court the next day showing her loyalty to Aaron. That is why this woman will always walk on water as far as I'm concerned. She's not perfect. No one is. Her compassion is an inspiration. Her love for him is something I will never forget. After our discussion, she refused to talk to the prosecutors, and by the way, Hagen never went near the gay issue when he called her to the stand toward the end of the trial. The big secret he couldn't tell me was just a bluff. Instead, he attacked her as if she was the accused, eliciting testimony that made little to no sense to the jury. The reporter being referenced in the interview with the Oxygen Channel is Michelle McPhee. McPhee is an ABC News producer and formerly a New York Daily News bureau chief. She is also an author of true crime books. A couple of days after Aaron was acquitted, she was invited on WEEI's The Kirk and Callahan Show to talk about her new book about an investigation of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. But she was also working on a forthcoming article for Newsweek that would break news about Aaron's sexuality, and she decided to share details with the so-called shock jocks before they went on air. The shock jocks began her interview by bringing it up. "This rumor," Jerry Callahan said on air, "this Aaron Hernandez rumor, which is so juicy, it is big. It's something we can certainly play with as the days go on," Kirk Minahane said. "I'm not sure how comfortable Michelle is in talking about it." McPhee was, however, open to talking about it. I mean, hey, she said to her radio pals, let's tease away. The three then went on an anti-gay rampage, using football metaphors to make fun of Aaron's sexuality. The men referred to Aaron as a tight end on and off the field, adding, then he became a wide receiver. The banter continued with McPhee adding that Aaron kicked with both feet. Within 24 hours of that radio interview hitting the public airwaves, Aaron would be dead. Did the interview have anything to do with Aaron's suicide? I don't believe so. But Aaron's sexuality was something that he and Shayana had to deal with as a family, not something to be joked about by some reporter trying to make headlines. At the center of all of this juicy gossip and judgment is a beautiful, innocent 4-year-old girl named Aviel Hernandez, who should not have to read about her father's sexual preferences in a vile and disgusting manner, because prosecutors were desperate to save a case they never should have brought. Chapter 21. Tears Behind the Glass. The day before I was to present closing arguments, I buried myself in the one-bedroom space I had rented at Devonshire Apartments in downtown Boston. We also had a 2-bedroom apartment upstairs that George and Linda shared. We called it the retirement home, thanks to George and Linda acting like an old married couple. George always did the laundry and the grocery shopping, and once had to take Linda to the emergency room, where he argued valiantly with a nurse about Linda's pain management. In practice, the Devonshire Apartments were more like our bunker. After leaving court each day, we would meet in the upstairs apartment around a huge work table and discuss everything that had transpired during the day and set up a game plan for the next. For all our planning, we never really knew what each day would bring. Often, we'd just have to go with the flow. Preparing for closing arguments is a bit different than making an opening statement. This is when I have to carefully plot out exactly what I want the jury to remember in order to understand our version of what took place. Most prosecutors like to use PowerPoints and verbally retrace their key points on the trial. I'm more of a storyteller. I like to use demonstrative aids during my closings. These are mainly photos of witnesses, the crime scene, and other exhibits presented in trial. If you blow them up and put them on poster board, jurors more easily remember faces and snippets of testimony. By highlighting dubious testimony and questionable evidence, I draw the roadmap to reasonable doubt. So the night before closing, I was locked in my apartment with 2 interns gathering headshots of witnesses who had testified during trial and compiling short video clips I wanted to use to highlight the points I wanted to make. Upstairs, George, Linda, and Michelle were working with a few other interns going over motions to be filed attacking certain issues that might come up. I like to walk the line between being methodical and being impulsive. I need to plan a strategy, but I'm not afraid to include spur-of-the-moment thoughts. I might get an idea about how to attack a piece of evidence or testimony using some weird visual aid, graphic, or recording, and then ask my team to make it happen. More often than not, they get it done. No one got much sleep while preparing for closing. I might do all the talking, but it's a team effort. Everything we had went into the production I was planning. Complicating matters was the fact that my back was killing me. The intense back pain was just the latest in my list of ailments that hit me during the trial. 3 weeks after I arrived in Boston, I caught the flu. Once that happened, my health slid downhill from there. One day during a sidebar, I could barely stand. I had to squat down to get some relief. Locke looked at me and said, "Go home." "To Florida?" I said, hoping my prayers had been answered, as I felt I could not take another day of this freezing weather. Locke ended trial early that day, and court was canceled the next day so I could recover. I spent the weekend in bed. Even so, after 3 months of being seated 8 hours a day, my back was killing me by the time closing arguments arrived. I woke up that morning and spent a good hour rehearsing the bullet points I wanted to hit. I was nervous and excited. It was the final stretch. I put on a blue suit with a white shirt and gray tie and looked in the mirror to give myself a quick pep talk. "You can do this," I said. The team gathered in the lobby and we left Devonshire Apartments as prepared as we could be. The doormen, who were starting to recognize us as Aaron's lawyers, offered us a good luck today as we walked out of the building. Once we arrived at court, I felt anticipation in the air. Maybe it was just me. Michelle would later tell me Aaron whispered to her, "I can't wait to see Jose do his thing." Judge Locke gave a lengthy instruction to the jury, in which he explained that closing arguments are the attorney's opportunity to review the evidence with you and argue to you as to what conclusions you should or should not draw from the evidence as you've heard it. My job as a criminal defense lawyer during my closing statement was to remind the jurors of the journey we'd taken over the past 5 weeks and show them where there was reasonable doubt. Jurors must know what reasonable doubt is for it to have life. I don't have to prove who is guilty or prove my client's innocence. I have to challenge the evidence. If the evidence is proven true, they can rely on it. If not, then they should discard it. I thought we had done that during the trial. In Massachusetts, the defense goes first during closing arguments. This was unusual for me. Everywhere else I'd practiced, the defense followed the prosecution. I like going second because I can respond to anything the prosecutor says during his closing. Unfortunately, I wouldn't have that tool in my toolbox at this trial. The day started a bit awkwardly. Before beginning, I looked at Judge Locke for his permission to speak by asking, "May it please the court?" Judge Locke had his head down, and I guess he didn't hear me. He scribbled notes, leaving me standing and waiting for his acknowledgement. After an uneasy 10 seconds of silence, which seemed longer for someone standing with a throbbing back, Judge Locke finally looked up and said, "Yes, sir." I thanked the jurors for their service, and then explained that my task was to make sure I remembered every single thing that related to reasonable doubt. So I opened with our basic premise. "There's absolutely no evidence that Aaron Hernandez committed this crime," I said. "What's scary is how easy it appears to be to get charged with such a serious crime." I started by placing a collage of photos from Cure Lounge on a large easel so it could be easily seen by the jury. I stressed that Aaron was there for only 9 minutes, and that there was no evidence of any interaction with Daniel de Abreu or a spilled drink, which was supposed to be the motive in the case. There was more evidence that Alexander Bradley lied about the whole incident. I mentioned that only half the video cameras worked. I pointed out that ex-detective Miller Thomas, the head of security for Cure, worked hand-in-hand with the police. I talked about how the chain of custody to preserve the integrity of evidence was never followed and shouldn't be accepted. I pointed out how the prosecution knew about the photograph Aaron took with Antoine Salvador, but didn't bring him to the stand. I even put up a picture of Salvador and mentioned how the prosecution had also ignored Jamie Furtado, who took the picture. I then put up a picture of Furtado. "They didn't speak to anyone who was in the club that night," I told the jury. I attacked Bradley's deal of a lifetime and how the prosecution had based its whole case on a drug dealer with a reason to lie. Because of the prosecutor's refusal to retract Bradley's deal of a lifetime, I came up with a description I thought painted a good picture of the situation by saying, "He was their three-legged pony, and they were going to ride him to the finish line." While I said this, I got a little excited and imitated a jockey whipping his horse, saying, "Come on, Rocky," as I began to gallop in the courtroom. I don't know what the hell I was thinking, but it felt right at the moment, and a couple of jurors could not hold back their laughter. I held up the picture of Aaron and Salvador and offered, "This is proof that Alexander Bradley is lying, because Bradley said he had been with Aaron the entire time." I reminded jurors of the video showing Aaron calmly walking out of the bar by himself and not with Bradley escorting him as he claimed. "It's an absolute lie," I said, still holding the picture of Aaron and Salvador in my hands. I then turned to the credibility of the police and their testimony, suggesting they didn't work hard enough to find the photo because it didn't fit into the story Bradley was trying to sell. The photo offered proof that Aaron didn't have time to get into a beef with anyone and that he was in a cordial mood that night. One visual I couldn't wait to present was of written quotes taken from the testimony of Detective Paul McIsaac, who had attempted to defend several obviously untrue statements made by Alexander Bradley. One side of the poster board read, "It's not true, but it's not a lie." The other side read, "Truthful, but inaccurate." I kept flipping those over and over so the phrases could soak into the jury. "How stupid does he think we are?" I asked the jury, referring to the officer's testimony. "Truthful, but inaccurate? That's what Alexander Bradley is," I said. "This sums up the case in regard to Alexander Bradley." "Come on, Rocky," the galloping continued. I used screenshots of videos to show there was no indication anything had been spilled on Aaron. There were no water stains on his clothing in his photo with Salvador or in video of him leaving Cure, even though everything happened in 9 minutes. "It's all reasonable doubt," I said. "The whole motive is crowded with reasonable doubt." I used the picture again to attack Bradley's story about what happened when he and Aaron walked to another bar across the street. I put Bradley's photo up and talked about his testimony describing how Aaron was enraged that the Cape Verdean crew had followed them to the second bar, even though there was video evidence that they stayed in Cure until it closed. "It's truthful, but inaccurate," I repeated, flipping the card. "It's not true, but it's not a lie." 30 minutes into my closing statement, I had showed that Bradley had lied about the spilled drink and lied about seeing the Cape Verdeans at the second bar. That's not what you should stand for, accepting lies, I told the jury. I reminded jurors that Judge Locke had instructed them at the outset to listen with caution and great care. I urged them to use this caution and care when reviewing Bradley's testimony. I knew the prosecution's entire case rested on whether the jury believed Bradley, and I couldn't do enough to discredit him. I detailed all the statements we had disproven. "Those are the lies of Alexander Bradley," I said. I was feeling good about the way things were going. I could tell the jury was engaged and listening. The painkillers and adrenaline were working on my back. Now it was time to talk more about the police. I played a small clip from the testimony of Boston Police Sergeant Sean McCarthy, one of the officers on the scene the night of the shooting. He had testified that photos of blood at the crime scene were a fair and accurate representation of what was there that night. The only problem was, he also admitted during testimony that he never saw the particular section of blood photographed. So how could he know whether it was a fair and accurate representation? Why did he not see the blood? I don't know. What's clear is he admitted never seeing the blood. That's admitting evidence falsely, I told the jury. If a sergeant in charge of a crime scene is willing to come here and admit evidence to you that he has no knowledge about and lie to you like that, then everybody is falling into rank. You can't accept that. That's unacceptable to any citizen accused, and that's the culture of deception throughout this case. It started with the scene that night and carried all the way through to the deal with the devil, I said, pointing to a picture of Bradley. Rocky is going to bring it home for them, I said, keeping my gallop a little more restrained this time. I saw a few eyebrows raised in the jury when I put up a picture of the second police officer on the scene, who was never called, and mentioned the absence of witnesses who had reported they saw a woman or female or someone wearing cornrows or long hair in the shooter's car. To stress the point, I instinctively pointed to Aaron and told him to stand up. This was not planned, but it was an if-it-doesn't-fit-you-must-acquit moment, and made one of the biggest impressions during the closing. Aaron wasn't expecting that at all, but he obediently jumped to his feet and stood tall and straight. He had lost weight during the trial, but he looked good in his dark suit and blue dress shirt. Standing there, he looked straight at me, wondering what I was about to do or say. "That's not this guy. That's not Aaron Hernandez," I said. "He doesn't have long cornrows. He doesn't look like a female by any stretch of imagination. Even if you squint as hard as they want you to, you're not going to get cornrows from him." All eyes were on Aaron as he sat down next to Sully, who rubbed his back as if to say, "Well done." For a man already convicted of murder and serving life without parole, Aaron seemed to connect with the jury. He would smile, make his defense team laugh at times, and was respectful to the judge and the prosecution. My team would tell me later that they could see the prosecution starting to squirm. They knew the jury was paying attention to what I was saying. Michelle said she could see Pat with his face down, looking anxious, especially when the video of Detective McIsaac was played saying Bradley was truthful but inaccurate. The head of the district attorney's office was in the courtroom, and so were all the major cops in Boston. They were all there waiting to hang Aaron, and I was determined to do my best to not let that happen. I reminded the jury how a forensic scientist concluded that the angle of the shots from the passenger side was completely impossible based on Bradley's testimony. "The science doesn't lie," I said. "The science is the only thing that doesn't have to take the witness stand and choose a side." I pointed out how Aquilino Friere was covered in blood and initially said he and his friends were in a gunfight. I also asked why Gerson Lopez and Rashide Sanchez left their dying friends at the scene. What were their motives? "Both of these guys ran," I said to the jury. "What did they take with them? Where did they go? Why are they destroying evidence? These are questions we must ask." Then I put pictures of 16 individuals on the board, 4 rows across and 4 rows down, all of them forensic witnesses for the Commonwealth, who said there was zero by way of forensic science that connected Aaron Hernandez to the Boston shootings. Zero. I could simply have said that verbally, but using the headshots of each witness was more dramatic. As I grabbed each picture, I announced, "No DNA, no fingerprints, no gun residue, no computer links, no ballistics, no gun tests." When all the pictures were off the board, I said, "This is what they're left with." I paused while the jury looked at an empty board. Next, I addressed what happened in West Palm Beach, pointing out that Bradley admitted he couldn't account for 2 of the 5 days he was down there, and refused to explain where he went or what he was doing. I also reminded the jury that the manager of Tootsie's said he gave Alexander Bradley his phone back, countering Bradley's claim that he had left his cell phone there. "He just can't tell you that truth. He's got an incentive, and he's lying all over the place," I said about Bradley. A couple of days earlier, Linda had shown me a meme going around social media showing Oprah Winfrey repeatedly pointing to members of her audience with a superimposed caption that read something like, "The Commonwealth handing out immunity." The meme was a takeoff on one of those episodes where an excited Oprah gives away cars or other expensive gifts to every member of her delighted studio audience. Over the course of the trial, the Commonwealth had granted immunity to at least half a dozen witnesses, and the jury knew it. I thought this meme was too good to pass up. The jury, the gallery, and even the press got a good laugh when I talked about the Commonwealth giving out immunity like it was candy on Halloween, and that Pat Hagen was the Oprah Winfrey of immunity. Pointing at various members of the jury as if they were Oprah's audience, I said, "You've got immunity. You've got immunity. Check under your chairs, ladies and gentlemen. You've all got immunity." The truth can sometimes be a very funny thing. I used more pictures to show that the shell casings in West Palm Beach were found outside of the car. Blood spatter and the hat Bradley was wearing were also outside the car, indicating he was shot outside the car, not inside as he had claimed. I talked about how Bradley was missing for about 5 minutes after he was shot. "He lives by the sword," I said of Bradley. "He's lying to you. He wasn't shot inside of the car. He was shot near the fence. His lies have carried all the way to Florida." My throat was beginning to burn as I headed toward my conclusion, which was the text message Bradley had sent to his lawyer and later tried to delete. I had put the words in big letters on a board and now placed it in front of the jury. "Now you sure once I withdraw this lawsuit that I won't be held on perjury after I tell the court the truth about me not recalling anything about who shot me?" Bradley's deleted text had been a bombshell discovery during the case. Here was the prosecution's star witness admitting to perjury, and the fact that his story about Aaron shooting him was totally fabricated. He was telling his lawyer what the truth was in a message never supposed to be seen. "He thought this message would never see the light of day," I told the jury. "That is your reasonable doubt for the entire case. And this stands as the cherry on top." I ended with a video compilation of Bradley's testimony, a memorable album of his lies. I referred to him as Rocky. My video presentation began with Bradley confidently saying his memory got better with time, followed by snippets where he couldn't recall this, that, or the other. He must have said, "I don't recall," or "I'm not sure," more than 24 times. I called it Rocky's greatest hits. I wanted to conclude by telling the jury about reasonable doubt and what it requires. I called it the highest burden in American legal jurisprudence, and I honestly believe that. But just as I was going to refresh the jury on the definition of reasonable doubt, Judge Locke interrupted me. "Counsel, I will give the instruction." This was an unexpected admonishment, considering raising reasonable doubt is the whole basis of a defense attorney's argument. Looking back, I was knocked off track for a moment. I think I had a flow going. Everyone was listening to every word as I ripped the Commonwealth's case and accused them of ignoring evidence that would have supported Aaron's innocence. I still maintain that Locke is one of the fairest judges I have ever practiced in front of, and I felt he had been fair throughout the trial. But as the trial came to a close, I sensed he was trying to offer some support to the Commonwealth. I had attacked the work of the Boston police and the prosecution's case. Maybe he was taking it personally. I couldn't act like I was rattled. Actually, I was pissed. Later on, at a sidebar, I told him that, "By not allowing me to argue and explain reasonable doubt, you have single-handedly ensured Mr. Hernandez's conviction." Those were powerful words, but I meant them and still do to this day. A defense lawyer should never be barred from explaining and arguing reasonable doubt. Regardless, I forced myself back on track and pointed out the facts that showed Aaron was not guilty of the charges. I then concluded my statements by acknowledging the jury. "I thank you all for your attention, and I thank you for your service on behalf of both sides." Hagen made his closing argument, which was powerful. He pushed the line and began arguing details about the gun connection to Aaron that were not in evidence, and Locke shut him down. Besides that, he was flawless. I can't recall seeing a prosecutor give a better closing argument. His delivery was flat out amazing, and for the first time I actually began to worry about a possible conviction. His closing argument was probably the one reason the jury took so long in their deliberations. As the jury deliberated, I felt good about the way the trial had gone. I thought we had done our best to discredit Bradley and offered plenty of reasonable doubt. Despite all the negativity in the press about Aaron, we really thought it was a slam dunk. As the defense team, we had lost our objectivity, but every time we reviewed the case, we all said to ourselves, how do they convict him? It's impossible, given the facts. Throughout the trial, we had felt the jury was with us every day. We followed their facial expressions closely. They would look at us a certain way, or react to some of the things the prosecution did in ways that led us to believe we were convincing them. Actually, I can't recall ever having a jury that seemed so clearly with us throughout the course of the trial. We did have our concerns about one or two jurors, especially when Judge Locke appointed a white woman named Lindsay Stringer as the foreperson. We viewed her as more pro-Commonwealth, but hoped our case was strong enough that it would only be a matter of time before the jury of 7 women and 5 men voted for an acquittal. You never spike the ball before you get into the end zone, but we felt good about our chances, at least until the jury came back with questions that seemed to indicate they were leaning toward a guilty verdict. At one point they asked the judge, if we feel there's enough evidence to convict, do we need corroborating evidence? Can we base our conviction solely on an immunized witness? What the hell kind of questions were those? I said to our team. Everybody was super down after hearing those questions. Aaron was too. I told him, I'm trying to stay positive, but those are some terrible fucking questions. After hearing the questions, we began rationalizing a possible conviction. We all sat there and agreed that if they convicted Aaron, it was because of Odin Lloyd and not this case. They couldn't get Odin Lloyd out of their minds, and there was nothing we could have done to win the case. Deliberations were entering their 6th day when Friday, April 14th, 2017 arrived. It was Easter weekend, and our team reasoned that a verdict likely wasn't going to be rendered until the following week. Linda made plans to return to New York, and I decided to head back to Miami to see a specialist about my back. They kept Aaron in a holding cell at the courthouse during deliberations so he could quickly change from his prison clothes into a suit to attend court. When I visited with him on Friday morning, the 6th day of deliberations, I told him, my back is done. If I don't get to Miami and have someone see this thing before I could finish, Aaron said, no, please go. Don't be ridiculous. There are plenty of people here. There was nothing I could have done. We were simply waiting on the decision. I said my goodbyes and gave him a big hug, knowing that if deliberations continued on to Tuesday, I would return. It was the last time I would see Aaron alive, and I cannot begin to describe the sorrow I feel as I'm writing this. The verdict came in while I was on the plane. Sully, Linda, George, and Michelle were there with Aaron as he was led into the courtroom by 4 guards who stood behind him as he stood for the verdict. Judge Locke first opened the manila envelope and looked at its contents. The court clerk then asked the foreperson, do you find the defendant not guilty, guilty of murder in the first degree, or guilty of murder in the second degree? Not guilty was the answer 5 times on both charges of murdering Daniel de Abreu and Saphiro Furtado, and for armed assault with intent to murder against Aquilino Friere, Gerson Lopez, and Rashides Sanchez. He was found guilty of unlawful gun possession. Sully held his arm around Aaron as the verdict was read. Aaron first nodded his head, then began to cry. Members of the victim's family slowly walked out of the courtroom as the not guilty verdicts were filed. The only sounds were of people crying. Judge Locke then thanked the jury for their careful attention to the evidence and disqualified them for jury service for the next 3 years. He then sentenced Aaron to 4 to 5 years for gun possession. Aaron gave Sully a big, long hug, then Aaron hugged George, and then Linda, and then Michelle, taking a second to glance toward Shayana. Normally, when my clients are acquitted, they go home. Aaron was taken back to the holding cell in the bowels of the courthouse. The team was escorted there minutes later to have a moment of celebration with him. When they arrived, Aaron had changed back into his prison clothes and was crying his eyes out. The teenager who hardly shed a tear when his father died and held in his emotions to mask the pain was now a grown man bawling like a baby. Michelle, George, Linda, and Sully could see Aaron, but a glass door kept them from hugging him. Instead, he reached his tattooed hands through an opening in the glass to exchange handshakes and smiles. Michelle would later regret not asking the bailiff to open the door so everyone could embrace. All we could do was put our hands in through the glass and touch his hands, she said. By then, the bailiffs had left them alone and couldn't be called. Touches would have to do. Aaron kept crying and saying, thank you, thank you. He was so grateful someone had believed him. Then it was time to go. Linda had made travel plans for New York and had to get to the train station. George and Michelle had to drive her there. After a 10-minute visit, It was time to leave. Aaron still had tears in his eyes when his lawyers left him. "I love you," he said one last time to his team. On the way toward the exit, Michelle had a bad intuition amid all of the celebration. She looked at George and said, "I felt so weird and sad leaving him behind like this. It was just an off feeling. I couldn't shake it."
Chapter 22. WTF. The South Florida sun felt like a soothing warm blanket wrapped around my skin. I might have been born in New York, but I'm a Florida boy through and through. If there aren't palm trees around, I don't want to be there. My body doesn't do cold, and that's all it had been while I was in Boston. Bone-chilling cold. As I walked down Brickell Avenue, a street near my home in Miami, I couldn't help but think of how good life was. 4 days earlier, I'd accomplished what many thought couldn't be done by getting Aaron Hernandez acquitted of double murder charges. Winning a jury verdict against those odds was exhilarating. As I thought about the outcome of the trial, what it meant for Aaron, and what it meant for my practice, I was in such a good mood. It was time to relax and enjoy a well-earned rest. My body needed it. Once a trial ends, whether it lasts 1 week, 3 weeks, or 3 months, my body and mind have to go through a decompression period. Trying a case is extremely taxing, both physically and mentally. People don't realize the effort that goes into even one full day of court. They figure you put on a suit and talk a little. Far from it. The mental fatigue is unlike anything I can describe. You have all the preparation you've made beforehand, memorizing certain things and listening to witnesses and processing what they're saying, with the knowledge you already have. And you're scared shitless. Scared that you missed something that could change the course of somebody's life forever. Each day you leave exhausted. Afterward, you really need time to get your head straight and get back into the groove of things. 4 days after the end of the trial in Boston, I was home in Miami and starting to feel like myself again. It was April 18th, 2017. I was still riding high from the acquittal, but all I wanted to do was sleep without being interrupted. I'd gotten into the habit of putting my cell phone away because people will call at all hours of the night, and if I'm really trying to get some sleep, I have to just turn off the phone and put it away. That's what I did. There was no reason I should have been bothered. I'd spoken with everyone I needed to, including Aaron. When I talked with him on what would turn out to be the final night of his life, he was so happy and so excited for the future. We discussed how we would have the resources to really go after an appeal in the Lloyd case. We were going to leave no stone unturned. He was excited because he had seen how committed we were to his cause. "I really feel I've got hope," he said. "I'm going to get out." After closing my eyes, I enjoyed the best sleep I'd had in quite some time, and I awoke expecting a relatively quiet day. Then I turned on my cell phone. It was flooded with text messages and missed calls, a lot of them from the 212 area code. Something had happened. I'd been down this road before. When big news breaks, area code 212 blows up on my telephone. It's media from New York calling. I clicked on one of the text messages from a good friend to see what was happening. There were three words that sent a chill through my soul. Aaron committed suicide. As happy as I'd been the night before, numbness and disbelief impaled me. I couldn't believe what I was reading. As I began to scan my text messages, I realized it was no joke, and then I noticed Shayana had been calling me since 5 o'clock in the morning. After seeing these missed calls, I pressed my iPhone to call her back. "Shay, what's going on?" "I got a call at 3 in the morning from the prison," she said, her voice choked with grief and fear. "They said Aaron hanged himself in his cell. They say he committed suicide. I'm on my way to the hospital. I can't believe it. Jose, this can't be happening." "I'll call Sully and have him meet you there," I said. "I will handle everything. Just go be with him. I will catch the next flight back. I'll take care of everything." Lawyer mode kicked in. My day of relaxation had turned into a day of horror. My mind began racing, trying to think of all the things I needed to do. Time was of the essence. I needed to get back to Boston. After hanging up with Shayana, I booked the next flight to Boston's Logan Airport. It was on JetBlue, leaving from Fort Lauderdale at 10:41 a.m. After the quickest shower of my life, I packed a small bag of clothes. I began calling the team: Sully, Linda, George, and Michelle. I made a list of what we had to address immediately. We had to make preparations for a second independent autopsy and preserve the integrity of the investigation. That meant filing a notice of preservation for the things in Aaron's cell. If anything of significance was being tested, we wanted some of it held back so we could do our own testing. And we needed to establish his estate and issue a press release. Something simple and informative, otherwise the press would not stop hounding us and Shayano. I called Linda Kenny Bodden to discuss not only Aaron's second autopsy, but also the idea that had lingered in the back of our minds for a very long time. Like so many other football players, could Aaron have suffered a brain injury that might explain his problems with memory and self-control? If we wanted answers, now was our chance. We'd have to move with lightning speed to preserve Aaron's brain and have it tested for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, as it is more widely known. I felt like the trial was on again. That's how it felt amid the chaos of it all. It wasn't until the drive to the airport that the reality of his death started to hit me. Aaron had been portrayed in the media as this callous thug who hung around with gangsters, threatened people with guns, and had no respect for his football career or human life. He was nothing like that. Yes, he had his dark side, and certain moments he was not proud of. But he was also kind, thoughtful, and the type of person who made you feel like he would do anything for you. As I drove north on I-95 toward the Fort Lauderdale Airport, I couldn't hold back the tears. I couldn't believe he had done this. I had not only lost a client, I had lost a friend. Harvey Levin from TMZ was the first reporter to actually get hold of me. He started firing off a million questions, but I was still in a fog, and all I basically gave him was a, "I am on it." We are investigating his death, and none of us saw this coming because Aaron was upbeat and happy. Until I know all the facts, I am not buying any of the stories. Within minutes, TMZ posted a story under the headline, "It could be murder, lawyer claims." I never said that, but I suppose he could have interpreted my words that way because I was questioning the validity of the suicide reports. It wasn't a stretch. I had stated the obvious, that I needed all the facts in order to understand what happened, but now rumors were flying that Aaron was murdered. If anything, the TMZ piece put everyone on notice that we planned to do our own investigation. That's what lawyers do. We question. We investigate for truth. None of the events of the past 24 hours made any sense. I've seen some pretty crazy shit done by law enforcement and government officials, and I don't put anything past anyone. 90% of the time, there's something off in any police report, and 20 to 30% of the time, the report will be flat out wrong, either intentionally or inadvertently or through negligence. Until we gathered all the evidence and conducted our own independent investigation, I wasn't going to accept anyone's conclusions. My first priority when I arrived in Boston was to check in on Shayana and make sure she was okay. One of our interns, Gian Favors, picked me up at Logan Airport and we drove to Shayana's home in Rhode Island. She and Aviel had left the mansion and put it up for sale after Aaron's conviction in 2015. They were now living in a two-bedroom townhouse near a golf course in North Providence. When I entered the house and saw Shayana, I gave her a tight hug. Just yesterday, we were discussing her coming to Florida to celebrate the victory with some friends and hoping for a better future. Now, Aaron was gone. "How could this happen?" she said. "Why now? Just when it looked like we had some hope he would be coming home." A few of her friends were with her when I got to her townhouse. The space was much smaller than the mansion she once decorated herself, but the rooms were tastefully decorated and filled with the same pictures of friends and family, pictures of love. Sully was also there, along with a paralegal. Aviel was with Shayana's mother, Jody, at a house nearby. Shayana was surrounded by good people. She had been estranged from her younger sister, Shania, Odin Lloyd's girlfriend, and had had virtually no contact with Aaron's family since the first trial. "I don't hear from them even now," Shayana had said. "I've been doing everything on my own, which is fine. I don't complain. My daughter is healthy and I'm breathing." Shayana was surprisingly strong. She was preparing food for the visitors and trying to stay busy. Being a single woman and having been through what she'd been through with Aaron, I can't begin to describe her strength. You can't rattle her. She's a rock. No one would blame her if she was devastated. She talked of her intention to visit Aaron in prison in the coming days. "It was all planned," she said. "It's like he didn't want to say goodbye." Aaron did say goodbye. He wrote 3 letters the night he died, letters discovered in his cell and released to us by corrections officials a few days after his death. One, written on ruled paper, was addressed to me. It was dated April 18th, 2017. "Jose, what's up, brother? Well, I wrote this letter following my acquittal and wanted to voice how I felt and let some people whose music helped me get through hard times know that it did. Wrong or right, who knows? I just follow my natural instincts and how it guides me. pros or cons, didn't weigh them, but I'm sure you'll let me know your view. Besides that, I want you to know you have me forever like you never understood, and time will reveal that I'm not perfect, but my love and loyalty is like you've never seen. I appreciate all your work, time, effort, and never let that slip your mind. In time, you will see how appreciated you are.